Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Lawrence O'Donnell, who's an Emmy Award-winning producer of NBC's The West Wing. He's also MSNBC's senior political analyst and a panelist on the McLaughlin Group. And he was the first reporter to identify that Karl Rove was named as the source in the leak to Matthew Cooper of Time magazine some time back. So given Lawrence O'Donnell's track record, we thought we'd get some clarity here on where things stand vis-a-vis Karl Rove and the special prosecutor. Then we'll also speak with Senator Bob Graham, who's a former two-term governor of Florida, three-term United States senator. He ran for president in 2004, and he was for 10 years on the Senate Select Intelligence Committee and later the chair of that committee. He, in fact, commissioned the National Intelligence Estimate that has become the basis of much of the disputes over the use of intelligence prior to the Iraq War, and we'll be talking to him about the hearings that took place this week for General Michael Hayden to succeed Portegas at the CIA. And then we'll talk about the resurgence of the Taliban and the role in that. The head of Afghanistan, Karzai, has accused the Pakistanis of encouraging jihad through their madrasas, and we're looking into the role that both Pakistan and India are playing in the resurgence of violence in Afghanistan. Let me begin with Lawrence O'Donnell, who I mentioned is the Emmy Award-winning producer of NBC's The West Wing, which just had its final episode recently. He's also MSNBC's senior political analyst and a panelist on the McLaughlin Group. He was a former contributing editor to the New York Magazine and a former Democratic chief of staff of the United States Senate Committee on Finance and the United States Senate Committee on the Environment and Public Works. Mr. O'Donnell has also served as a senior advisor to Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. And he's also an actor on the HBO series Big Love. And Lawrence O'Donnell, we spoke several times over the last year or so vis-a-vis the Karl Rove Fitzgerald inquiry, and you were the first, as I mentioned, to identify Karl Rove as the source of the leak to Matthew Cooper of Time magazine. And since then, there's been, particularly in the last week or so, there's been some confusion over whether or not Karl Rove is to be indicted. And in fact, there was some confusion here on this program because several websites were saying that Karl Rove's speech to the American Enterprise Institute was canceled. We checked with the website. Indeed, it had been taken down off the website, but nevertheless, he went ahead and gave the speech. So we certainly got that wrong. I guess, is this a case of the blurring of the line between the blogosphere and journalism?
Yes, it is one of those exercises where the blogosphere has proven its weaknesses against establishment journalism. None of the speculation that you're talking about found its way into print in the New York Times and in the mainstream media. It all occurred on blogs and websites. And most of the time in this story, however, in the last year, the blogs and the websites have been brilliant and absolutely necessary in pointing out some of the areas that the mainstream media had missed in this story and some of the basic questions that they had missed. And I myself used the Huffington Post to blog basically directions to Washington reporters about how to question Karl Rove's lawyer, for example, when he would raise certain technicalities that would mystify the Washington press corps. So the blogosphere actually has been extremely helpful in focusing the mainstream media's questions in this arena, because it's an interesting role because most people who are writing on blogs don't ever have the opportunity to be in a White House press conference, and they don't ever have the opportunity to actually speak to Rove's lawyer. And so what is happening is that the Washington Post reporters and the New York Times reporters and LA Times reporters and all of the mainstream media are reading all the same blogs that you are in on this case, and they are very frequently taking specific direction from those blogs on how to follow the story. What is true is that the mainstream media is always going to use a higher standard of evidence in order to print something that is somewhat speculative. So none of them were caught in that trap that erupted last week. I can tell you that I was getting calls from MSNBC week before last and last week saying, we think the indictment is going to come down on Friday. Are you available? Can you please make sure that you can, you know, be at the studio? And I got the same calls this week. They said, you know, we think it's either going to be Wednesday or Friday because Fitzgerald has this pattern of convening his grand jury on Wednesday or Friday. And I just listened to it and thought, no one knows what they're talking about. There's absolutely no evidence for the speculation that was going on inside the blogs and the speculation that was going on inside the mainstream media, but never bubbled out publicly in the mainstream media.
Well, I guess the opposite's happening in terms of predictions here. On Chris Matthews this morning, Caddy Kay of the BBC has gone out on a limb and said that Karl Rove would not be indicted because the special prosecutor had this inclination. He declined to indict. Conversely, there is other talk in the New York Daily News that even if Karl Rove escapes indictment, he could still be forced to resign for talking with the Time magazine reporter because he would, in effect, be named as an unindicted co-conspirator.
Yeah, I doubt very much that at this point that Fitzgerald would go to the unindicted co-conspirator status with Rove. He might. I don't think any of us know enough about exactly the way Fitzgerald will analyze his prosecutorial responsibilities in those gray areas. I think what you heard, the prediction you heard on television this morning, is pure guesswork. Caddy Kay has absolutely no idea what Fitzgerald is thinking. I will say that my leaning, if I was forced into a prediction, which I have not done, I've done no predicting in the last couple of months on what was going to happen here, but my guess, based on my conversation with a source involved in the case, would indicate to me that the indicators have a very slight leaning toward Rove not being indicted. And one of the last thing I wrote about this on Huffington Post was that the very important component of Rove's last appearance in front of the grand jury was who requested the appearance. And my point was that if Rove requested one more shot at the grand jury, that meant that Rove's lawyer firmly believed Rove would be indicted, and therefore he sent Rove in one more time to try to save himself from being indicted. If, on the other hand, Fitzgerald requested Rove's last appearance in front of the grand jury, that would indicate that Fitzgerald did not have enough to indict him before requesting that last appearance. It would also indicate that Rove's lawyer believed that if Rove accepts Fitzgerald's invitation to make a last appearance in front of the grand jury, he will not hurt himself. He will not get himself into more trouble. He can only help himself. Rove's lawyer claimed after the fact of Rove's last grand jury appearance.
That's his fifth grand jury appearance.
Yeah, that it was Fitzgerald's request that Rove appear before the grand jury. Now, nothing Rove's lawyer has said of that sort of specificity has ever been proven false. So at the moment, if I accept Rove's lawyer's statement that it was Fitzgerald's request that Rove testify that final time, then I would be willing to bet $1 on the basis of everything I've just said that Rove will not be indicted.
So presumably that was Fitzgerald's last moment to decide one way or the other whether or not to indict.
He would not, if Fitzgerald requested Rove's final appearance, he would not have made that request if he had enough to indict. You will notice in the Libby pattern, Libby was not invited back to the grand jury repeatedly before being indicted. Libby did not do the five appearances to the grand jury. Libby simply lied to the, I think it's very obvious. I don't think this involves real judgment calls, but Libby obviously lied to the FBI questioners. He then obviously went in and told the same lies to the grand jury, And Fitzgerald just indicted him. Didn't need any more. It was very simple lying, saying that Tim Russert told him about Valerie Plame. Tim Russert testifies that, that's absolutely untrue. And so that's, you know, it's a very clear black and white case. You believe Libby or you believe Tim Russert. That's it. And that's a that was a really easy, clean, simple indictment for Fitzgerald to execute. With Rove, obviously, he's in a very Fitzgerald finds himself in an extremely cloudy territory. And I my guess about Fitzgerald as a prosecutor in this particular instance is that he is going to be scrupulously careful and not overreach one inch beyond what his evidence convinces him of. And if his evidence does not convince him of Rove's guilt, I don't believe Fitzgerald will indict him.
But also, I think, Lawrence O'Donnell, it's logical that if Rove's indictment is hovering there as a possibility, then being called in for a fifth time, this time by the special prosecutor, even though it may indicate that he won't be indicted, it could also indicate that Fitzgerald wanted one last thing or something cleared up, and we don't know whether it was cleared up or not.
Absolutely. That's the other part of this. That's the other angle on it, is that Fitzgerald is so scrupulous that even though he felt he had enough to indict, he called him in one more time just to make sure that there wasn't any final bit that wasn't clear to Fitzgerald. My analysis on these on the Fitzgerald process comes from primarily federal prosecutors who have gone through this themselves, who I know personally have known for a long time. And they, when they see these different moves on the chessboard, they say to me, I think this means this and I think that means that. Some of them say it with absolute certainty. I mean, I have some former federal prosecutors, U.S. attorneys, who say to me with absolute certainty that they read this pattern as there being no doubt that Rove will not be indicted. And I have others who read the same pattern with the same level of expertise who are undecided about it.
Well, this is almost like having the Reverend Pat Robinson predict the weather.
It is. It's because it's taken up so much time in the calendar. By the way, it is not long in legal time. We have to remember that, you know, that Time magazine and the New York Times spent a year delaying this by trying to hide evidence from Matt Cooper and hide evidence from Judy Miller. So they ate up a year of this on the clock of this case, and Fitzgerald has otherwise moved very quickly. But in the news universe, a year is a long time. So we all have to talk about it during this entire period of time. But we've definitely at this point, weeks ago, slipped off of a cliff into pure guesswork. There is no news in this case since Rove's last appearance to the grand jury. No news whatsoever. But it is legitimate to continue talking about it, and what we have to be careful of is knowing exactly where the line is on guesswork. So if I provide you with a guess on this show, I will label it as that. I'm not giving you any predictions today because I don't have any.
But Lawrence O'Donnell, in terms of this story in the broad sense, it's been something of an indictment of the press in terms of Tom Jefferson's idea that the press is the guardian of the public and the advocate for the public. It seems that much of the appearance is that the press have actually been covering up for the wrongdoers inside the government itself.
Yes, I was the first person I heard say that. Let me put it to you that way. Mm-hmm. I remember going on Al Franken's radio show right after Floyd Abrams, back in his early defense of Judy Miller, and I was impolite enough, and Floyd was being presented as the hero of the First Amendment, and isn't he doing God's work? And I was impolite enough to point out that if Floyd Abrams succeeds, we will absolutely never know who might have broken the law in the Bush White House on this matter. And that Floyd Abrams was functioning, in effect, as defense counsel to the White House, and in effect, cover-up counsel to the White House. Now, I don't mean that in any way as an insult to Floyd Abrams. He was doing his duty as a lawyer, and he was following exactly what the legal code of ethics says he should do. He was doing the right thing in terms of his clients, the New York Times and Judy Miller. However, most lawyers, in the course of their careers, frequently find themselves in disservice to the truth. they find in service to a particular client, you may be in disservice to the truth. This was absolutely a case of that with the Time Magazine lawyers and the New York Times lawyers. And because, you know, the some elements have portrayed entities like the New York Times and Time Magazine as the liberal media establishment, a lot of liberals have gotten the notion in their heads that this is the New York Times, this is the same thing as, you know, Daniel Ellsberg's Pentagon Papers being published in the New York Times, and we're on the side of whatever the liberal New York Times is fighting for in terms of its constitutional rights. Well, it took people the better part of a year to start to think differently about that, and it really took the final revelation of the basic truth of it, that that Matt Cooper's legal effort was one that functioned as, was not intended to be, but functioned as a cover-up for Karl Rove. And once liberals discovered that, they started to realize, oh, there's more than one issue in this thing that I have that I have an interest in. I have an interest in freedom of the press. I have an interest in reporters being able to protect their sources for whistleblowers. But I also have an interest in knowing exactly who the sources of these reporters were. And those things came into conflict, and liberals had to make their decision. It was easy for me. I firmly believed all along that the reporters had absolutely no constitutional protection. I had read the law on it, and it was very clear to me that they were going to be forced by the Supreme Court to testify. And it was clear to me that at some point they would. And it was also, it was still clear to me when Judy Miller went to jail that at some point she would testify her way out of jail. And the entire legal exercise run by Time Magazine and the New York Times for over a year would do nothing other than protect the Bush campaign and allow its reelection, because if those reporters had testified and cooperated with the prosecutors as quickly as Robert Novak obviously did in 1994, we could have had public information in October of 1994 that Karl Rove was indeed the source to Matthew Cooper. This story could have come out before the election of November of 1994, and we could have had a different president.
And you have to add to this, Lawrence O'Donnell, the role of Time Magazine reporter Vivica Novak, who essentially tipped Karl Rove's lawyer off, Luskin, that he was in trouble.
Yeah, that was a pure journalistic crime, and I called it such at the time. Time Magazine did a face-saving move when Vivica Novak's role was exposed, and they gave her a leave of absence. I knew that was the end of her journalistic career. She was treated very gently by the media, very gently, because Vivica is well known to all of us in Washington, and she's a very nice person, and everybody likes her. And she was given a huge pass when that came out. You've read a lot more nasty stuff about Judy Miller from her colleagues, and virtually nothing nasty about Vivica Novak by anyone that I'm aware of in this story. That was a stunning moment to discover that Time Magazine is spending all of its money, wisely or unwisely, in protecting this secret, and Matthew Cooper is facing jail to protect this secret, and Vivica Novak not only reveals the secret over drinks, as she says, but she reveals it to Rove's lawyer. That was like a cop, you know, handing evidence over to the mafia about their here's your wiretaps. Here, what else do you want to know of what we have on you? You know, it was a stunning moment. It was by far the most disgraceful journalistic moment in this story.
Well, just in closing, Lawrence O'Donnell, what is the role, or if any, of former Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage? He's apparently, according to some reports, he's emerging as a key witness in this probe.
Well, there's the notion that he, that we don't know this yet, but the popular notion is that he was the person who told Bob Woodward about Valerie Plame long before any other administration official told any other reporter, including Novak or Matt Cooper or Judy Miller, about Valerie Plame. And it may be the case, but we really don't have enough about it. It also doesn't seem, oddly enough, it doesn't seem particularly relevant. It seems on the the notion of it that has emerged so far is that this was really a one-on-one moment between Woodward and Armitage, and that neither one of them was involved in then advancing the story beyond that. And it may, now if his name shows up talking to other reporters about this, then he could conceivably have a role in Fitzgerald's larger picture about what was going on and this collective, if not conspiratorial, intent of administration officials to discredit Joe Wilson. But it doesn't seem that Armitage plays a yet significant role in Fitzgerald's description of the administration's legal conspiracy to discredit Joe Wilson.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Lawrence O'Donnell.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Lawrence O'Donnell, who is the Emmy Award-winning producer of NBC's The West Wing. He's also MSNBC's senior political analyst and a panelist on the McLaughlin Group, where some time ago he was the first reporter to identify that Karl Rove was the source of the leak to Matthew Cooper of Time magazine. He's also a former Democratic chief of staff to the United States Senate Committee on Finance and the United States Senate Committee on the Environment and Public Works, and he served as a senior advisor to Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. I'm now speaking with Senator Bob Graham, who's a former two-term governor of Florida, three terms in the United States Senate, and he ran for president in 2004. He served on the Senate Select Intelligence Committee for 10 years and became the chair of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee during the critical 18 months of 2001 to 2002. And he was responsible for generating the national intelligence estimate that became it's still being argued about today, Senator Graham. We just recently learned that the President Bush authorized selective leaks of the NIE, leaks favorable to his interpretation of the weapons of mass destruction, leaving out the caveats from the State Department and from the Department of Energy about the aluminum tube story. But in general, what going back to that critical moment, because essentially you they're about to go to war without even bothering to have an NIE. You forced the administration to accept an NIE, and then they had that fateful vote on October of 2003 on the war resolution, largely based upon at least senators all had access to the NIE. You were one of the few senators who voted against the war, and ironically, the vote for the war has continued to haunt both Senators Kerry and Edwards. Irony of ironies, why is it, do you think, in retrospect, why so many of your colleagues, including your counterpart on the House Intelligence Committee, Jane Harman, didn't take your lead?
First, Ian, thank you very much for the opportunity to be back with you and your listeners. I'm not going to impugn the integrity of other members of Congress. They each had their own reason for making the decision. I think some of it was the fact that there's a long tradition of following the lead of the president in national security matters. If the president of the United States tells you that he is confident that your adversary has weapons of mass destruction and that he is capable of using those weapons on a 45-minute notice, which is what the president essentially told Congress, I believe Congress has a right to believe in what he said and the credibility that he brings to those statements. We've now learned that neither of those was, in fact, the case. Second, this vote was held within a few weeks of the midterm election in 2002. There were a lot of people who were either running or had colleagues who were running who were reluctant to be seen as being opposed to a man who was still at the relative height of his popularity, President Bush. So those are all factors that were swirling around. Just in summary, my basic two reasons for voting against the war is, first, I thought that our greater threat to the people of America were from the groups that had just killed 3,000 Americans, not from Saddam Hussein. And second, I was very suspicious of the information we were getting that Saddam Hussein was trying to reconstitute his weapons of mass destruction, the unwillingness of the administration to have a thorough multi-agency examination of the intelligence upon which that statement was made was just one piece of that basis of suspicion.
Well, Senator Graham, it's also worth noting that the majority leader, Senator Daschle, did go to the White House and met with Karl Rove and President Bush and tried to urge them to delay the war resolution vote until after the midterm elections. But the White House was having no part of it because it essentially it seemed to play out of Karl Rove's playbook. And it leads me to the broader question, isn't this an example of the politicization of intelligence?
And it's the only purpose of intelligence is to add an additional element to what is known through open sources so that the decision maker can make a more informed judgment. If the intelligence becomes used as a means of validating a decision that has already been made, then you and all the taxpayers of the United States are spending many billions of dollars unnecessarily. And I think clearly this was a case in which the administration made up its mind, at least as early as the beginning of 2002, because it was at about that time we started to move personnel and equipment which had been critical to the victories that had been achieved in Afghanistan out of Afghanistan to get ready for a war in Iraq that was still some 14 or 15 months off. That was a clear signal that the administration had already decided, and what happened from that point forward were just ways to try to justify this shift of attention away from al-Qaeda and towards Saddam Hussein, and the emotion to engage in one of the first preemptive wars in America's history.
Well, now, when you were the chair of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, were you there when Tyler Drumheller, he's subsequently gone public on 60 Minutes, and he was the head of the CIA's operations in Europe, and he knew quite a bit about the source of Colin Powell's speech to the UN, the so-called curveball. But he apparently he's told the committee that the CIA had an asset in Saddam Hussein's cabinet, a foreign minister who was on the CIA's payroll, and this source had told them that Saddam had no WMD.
I do know that the United States had no one, zero, in Baghdad whose job it was to verify the statements that were being made about the existence of weapons of mass destruction. The irony is the administration gave us maps and other written materials indicating that there were precisely 550 sites in Iraq where weapons of mass destruction were either being produced or stored. For many of those, there was a street address. You would have thought that we would have had the common sense and capability to go and knock on some of those doors and find out what, in fact, was behind them. Without doing that, we were almost totally reliant on the exile community, which was providing this information. Many of the exiles hadn't lived in Iraq for 10 or 20 years. All of them had a strong interest in getting the United States involved militarily so that they would be able to return to power. And I note in today's news that Mr. Chalabi, one of the leaders of the exiles, who was a major provider of a lot of this erroneous information, is now under active consideration for one of the three most significant ministries in the new government.
But it is a fact that the CIA had literally a guy inside the inner circle of Saddam, the foreign minister. I mean, that's what Tyler Drumheller said only a few weeks ago on. It's been reported a number of times. But
yeah, I can't speak to that specifically.
I understand. Let me then turn to the broader questions then, Senator Graham, about the state of intelligence. We've got, obviously this week we had hearings for General Hayden to succeed Porter Goss at the CIA. Just in watching the hearings for General Hayden, the questioning was so partisan, I mean, in the sense that the Republicans were asking friendly, softball, non-questions, and a couple of the Democrats asked, you know, probing questions, Ron Wyden and Carl Levin. So from your point of view, having served as the chair, what happened to this idea? Again, we mentioned earlier how Karl Rove effectively seems to be running the foreign policy, and there's a tremendous political dimension to everything that's done, putting the National Guard on the border this week, the tax cut, everything, all the governance seems to be done for public relations reasons nowadays, not for what's good for the nation. But give me a sense of how these nonpartisan committees became so partisan.
Well, it's even more serious, Ian, in the sense that unlike almost every other area of the federal government, whether it's transportation, environment, health, there are many eyes watching what the agencies are doing. There's the media, there's interest groups, there's the public at large. But with intelligence, there's almost only one eye, and that is the oversight committees of the Congress, because the rest of society is largely shut out from the activities of those agencies. So it's especially important in carrying out that function that the committees function understanding that their responsibility is to the American people, not to a political party. And I'm very distressed at the partisanship which has developed. I think there are several reasons for that. One is the fact that partisanship has become more severe across the board in American politics. Second is that intelligence has become more front and center since 9/11. People have come to recognize its importance to our national security. Third, I think this administration has got a lot to hide in terms of its activities. For instance, I think the two biggest unanswered questions of 9/11 are, one, what was the full extent of the role of Saudi Arabia in helping the hijackers? And two, why has the administration gone to such lengths to prevent the securing of an answer to that question? There are very sensitive areas that the administration does not want Congress to be involved with, and they've been able to convince their partisans on the Intelligence Committee to essentially frustrate full investigations.
Well, you know, this has led to a kind of cult of paranoia in this country vis-a-vis 9/11 conspiracy theories.
Yes, I don't think it does not serve us well to have these big voids of unknown, which are susceptible to becoming known. Why I think this issue of Saudi Arabia is so important is because I don't think that the hijackers could have been successful, given their own personal backgrounds, unless they had had some significant support from an infrastructure that was already in place before they arrived. And if that was the case, then it's not. There's only been one person who has paid a price for 9/11, and that's Massawi, who is going to spend his life in jail. Nobody in any of the agencies which were found to be derelict in their duty have been disciplined, and no one else has been brought to trial for their role as complicitous in this. I think that's an outrage contributes to our lack of security.
Well, I think that you can broaden that out, Senator Graham, and in the extent to which there has never been any accountability in this administration. There's been no accountability from the president or from the the president's national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, vis-a-vis their kind of lackadaisical attitude. When they came in, anything that Clinton suggested to them, they automatically dismissed. They were only focused on selling Star Wars as a national security panacea. They, according to people inside the White House that were there, like Richard Clark, he had a hard time getting any attention vis-a-vis. And remember that memo, the famous memo of Al-Qaeda determined attack in the United States, that was breezily dismissed by Condoleezza Rice. So I just get the general impression that, you know, that we have an administration who put a price on, a greater price on loyalty than competence, and the last thing that you'll ever get out of this crowd is accountability.
They certainly have been avoiding it in a wide range of areas. As in a totally different field, I was a member of the Senate Finance Committee, which has responsible for programs like Medicare, and I was very much opposed to the way in which the Republicans shaped this prescription drug program. And one of the things they did is they told the members of the Congress that this program was going to cost $400 billion over 10 years. I knew that it was at least double that number. And the irony was, I knew it because the people inside the agency had told me what they thought it was going to cost, and they had also told the administration. But the administration essentially withheld that information, and the consequence is we've got a bad program that is grossly overpriced to the American taxpayer.
Well, then this does, though, extend to what's happened to in the name of so-called intelligence reform. And I've used the analogy that the meltdown over WMD and 9/11 has resulted, the accident has resulted in the car being blamed and not the driver. So much of what seems to be being done in terms of the establishment of the Director of National Intelligence, which is a sort of political layer between the president and the agency. They no longer brief. He's apparently one of the reasons that Portagos resigned was that Negroponte wanted to take over the Iraq analysis from the CIA because they were not happy with the fact that the people in the CIA kept telling the truth, and they in fact fired or forced the resignation of the station chief in Iraq because he was giving them bad news. And this reminds me of what went on during the Vietnam War, that the CIA were the only agency in the government that told the administrations of Johnson and Nixon the truth, and the Pentagon were just having these fantasies called the 5 o'clock follies. So are we heading down this path where we're not going to have any truth tellers left in the government?
Well, the answer is I hope not. I hope that we're going through an aberrational, not a substantive change in our attitude towards the importance of intelligence being willing to tell truth to power. We're paying an enormous price for what has happened under this administration's watch. Yesterday there was a major story about a division in the negotiating positions between the United States and our European, as well as Russian and Chinese allies on Iran. And one of the issues was we're saying that Iran is rapidly reaching the point of no return in terms of its capability to produce nuclear weapons. The other people don't believe us. So we're being stripped of our credibility, even with our own allies, on an important issue. So I think it'll be scored not in years, but in decades, maybe even generations before we can rebuild our credibility with the world and with the American people.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles today, Senator Bob Graham.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I'm just speaking then with Senator Bob Graham. He's a former two-term governor of Florida, three terms United States Senator. He ran for president in 2004, and he was for 10 years on the Senate Select Intelligence Committee. He was the chair in a critical period between 2001 and 2002. His most recent book is Intelligence Matters, the CIA, the FBI, Saudi Arabia, and the Failure of America's War on Terror. And we're talking about the General Hayden's confirmation hearings and other matters relating to intelligence. Let's now talk with Chris Fair, who's a senior research associate at the United States Institutes of Peace's Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. She specializes in South Asian political and military affairs, and she's an expert on security competition between India and Pakistan, Pakistan's internal security, analysis of causes of terrorism and U.S. strategic interests, and relations with India and Pakistan. And Senator Graham was just talking about how the 9/11 Commission never really filled in the full picture of Saudi Arabia's involvement in 9/11. Is there any reason to be also skeptical of Pakistan's cooperation vis-a-vis any possible role they had in 9/11 or in any prior intelligence and awareness of these plots, which are, after all, being hatched in their backyard?
I don't think there's any reason to have those kinds of doubts about Pakistan. I don't think there's any evidence upon which one could base that allegation.
I see. Well, what about the current allegations coming from Karzai, the Afghan leader, accusing Musharraf's government of encouraging the madrasas, or not doing anything about the madrasas, who were encouraging young men to come across the border and do jihad?
Well, I think there are a couple of different allegations that are getting conflated. On the first issue, what Karzai is accusing Musharraf of doing or not doing is basically encouraging and actively training, in fact, a neo-Taliban set of actors to conduct operations in Afghanistan. And in point of fact, this is an allegation that's been going on, well, really, since about 2002. You may recall when Khalilzad was ambassador to Kabul, there was a very healthy set of exchanges between our embassies in Kabul and in Islamabad about the extent to which Pakistan was either actively aiding or passively aiding by not doing enough the attacks that are ongoing in Afghanistan. The second set of issues, the madrasas, this is a complex issue because there are many different kinds of madrasas, and the Pakistan government has a different relationship depending on the kind of madrasas that we're looking at. So if we're thinking about madrasas writ large across Pakistan, there's not a lot of evidence that the preponderance of terrorists are coming from these madrasas. This is an area that I've done quite a bit of work on. Where you have an exception to this will be in those madrasas that are in the tribal areas. And so I think there are a couple of different issues here that for us to really understand what Pakistan is or is not doing, we have to kind of take them apart bit by bit.
But clearly there's an uptick in violence and many more attacks. And just this week, an American involved in drug eradication was killed, and a Canadian, female Canadian officer was killed. NATO are deploying there now, and apparently the Afghan army is being trained and starting to be deployed. But there's just a general impression that this may be another case of a premature mission accomplished.
Well, that may be the case, but with respect to Pakistan and these neo-Taliban, I think there are a couple of ways that one sort of has to understand what Pakistan is doing or is not doing. And I think it's fair to say that Pakistan is probably pursuing a two-track strategy. That is, on the one hand, it is giving verbal support to Karzai, and in fact, it understands that in the long term, what Pakistan will benefit from is from a stable Afghanistan, one which will let Pakistan get into Central Asia. It'll be very good for it commercially. It'll be good for it politically and diplomatically to be seen supporting a positive Afghanistan or a healthy Afghanistan. But Islamabad also sees a lot of disconcerting signs. So, for example, the Indians, who have always had a better relationship with Afghanistan than Pakistan has a pretty heavy presence. You'll often hear about the ring of consulates. And Pakistanis see that as an intelligence presence. So the Pakistanis are very concerned that if there is going to be a stable Afghanistan, that it's going to be a stable Afghanistan that's hostile to Pakistan. And it doesn't really know how to have a relationship with Afghanistan where Afghanistan is just a neighbor and not a client. So this is why I think we're seeing Pakistan relying upon a strategy which it has generally relied upon since independence, one of proxies. And the other thing I'd like to point out is that Pakistan largely expects the international community to leave Afghanistan. And what will happen in the departure of the U.S. international community will be a recrudescence of the Taliban. So Pakistan doesn't really want to let go of its ties with this particular set of actors, given that it believes that in the long term, it's going to have to be dealing with them again.
So, but at the moment, they're concerned. You mentioned the ring of consulates, the Indian consulates. Apparently, there's also Indian companies in there building roads.
Oh, absolutely.
And so they think that India is meddling on their other flank, given that they're confronting India on their eastern flank, and there's been almost wars, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and I think it's important to not just look at Afghanistan. The Indians have a very good set of relations with the Iranians, and you may have observed some of the debate going on in Congress right now because we're about to President Bush would like Congress to basically finalize through an act of legislation a civilian nuclear deal between the United States and the Indians. And so the issue of the Iranian-Indian relationship has been raised. And, for example, there's a military presence there, an Indo-Iranian military presence. They've opened up a number of consulates. There's actually a very impressive consulate in a town of Zahedan, which I had the pleasure of visiting in 2001. And so Pakistanis are not only looking at what the Indians are doing in Afghanistan, they're also looking at Iran and also Indian presence in Central Asia. In fact, India just opened up the second air base in Tajikistan and explicitly spokespersons that were interviewed upon the opening of that base, that it was to expand India's strategic reach. So Pakistan has a lot to worry about. And so when you take a look at the region, not just Afghanistan, I think you kind of get a bigger idea of what it is that Pakistan is trying to hedge against.
But on the other hand, they're running headlong on a collision course with the United States and with the NATO partners, because NATO is deploying soldiers in the south and the west as we speak, and the United States is behind the training of an Afghan national army.
Absolutely.
And the only people they're fighting are the Taliban. And if you're saying that Pakistan's long range proxy interest isn't having a resurgent Taliban, then
Now let me be really clear about what I mean. Like I said, Pakistan has what I will call a two track strategy. That is that it, on the one hand, it is trying to act in a way that will make a stable, healthy Afghanistan possible. Yet, on the other hand, because it does fear what a stable Afghanistan may look like vis-a-vis its relationship with Islamabad. And I'd like to remind you that when Pakistan became independent, there was only one state that opposed to Pakistan's admission to the UN, and that was Afghanistan. It has an outstanding unresolved border with Afghanistan. Most people don't appreciate that. They know the unresolved border issue with India, but not with Afghanistan. And there has been a long-standing ethnic group in Pakistan claiming variously some degree of autonomy, the Pakhtuns. So even though Pakistan understands that it cannot be on the wrong side of the United States on Afghanistan, Pakistan is not putting to sleep, in my view, and I think in the views of others, this proxy force that it can use to sort of hedge its bets in the case that Afghanistan does stabilize and is hostile to Pakistan. And it's, of course, what's so peculiar about this is that this hedging strategy actually makes the outcome of a stable Afghanistan seem less likely, even though that would in the long term benefit Pakistan. So this is very, I think, typical of Pakistani strategic analysis. You saw this, you see this, and you continue to see this in its relationship with India. That is to say, pursuing a track of normalization while also keeping in reserve these militants. And we saw them, you know, in the earthquake. I mean, Pakistan said there were no militants up there, and the earthquake happened, and the militants were at the forefront of aid delivery. So I think this way of pursuing two different policy options that are, in fact, mutually irresolvable is actually kind of a hallmark of Pakistani decision-making. Mm. And we often hear, of course, that Pakistan has remanded, 500, 600, 700 individuals since the onset of the global war on terrorism. But what I always like to point out to people is not a single one of those individuals a high-ranking Taliban member.
Well, Chris Fair, this begs the overall question, though, from the United States' point of view. Given that we've got more than our hands full in Iraq, we certainly don't need a resurgence of trouble in Afghanistan, even though we certainly are getting it. Why don't we try and co-opt the Pakistanis and accede to their interests? What's preventing us?
Well, see, I think that for me is the core question, and I think that there are a couple of answers. One, no one really has the evidence to say that this is Pakistan state policy. Although, if you go back and you look at some of the news reports from the Waziristan operations in 2004. What we actually saw, we had journalists going into Waziristan and interviewing the security forces. Actually, I have associates in Pakistan who observed personally Taliban crossing back and forth across that border with Afghanistan. And he personally went and he asked the Tochi scouts, which is the paramilitary force that was providing security at that part of the border, why aren't you stopping these Taliban? And what my associate was told was that we were not given instructions to stop the Taliban. And this is a Tochi scout. So going back to 2004. But the question is this just passive facilitation by not doing enough? Do we have retired ISI persons? Do we have active ISI persons? The question, at which point does the active state become involved in this policy, is really important, but the evidence to make an adjudication one way or another is very difficult. So it's definitely the kind of strategy that we've seen Pakistan pursue before, which is sort of like plausible or in some cases implausible deniability. So there is a little bit of diplomatic politeness going on here. We do know, of course, President Bush raised this issue when he went to South Asia in February and March of this year, and perhaps he would not have raised it had he not first gone to Afghanistan, where Karzai gave him this list of terrorists that are Pakistani that are operating in Afghanistan. So why is it that we are in a situation where we suspect strongly either passive or some level of active state support, we're not doing enough about it? I mean, that's, I think, to me, is the most important policy question. Now, I suspect that the United States government may be getting exhausted with this game of cat and mouse. I mean, we did see these Bajor missile strikes, certainly most recently in January, but there was a previous set of missile strikes as well. So maybe you've seen these press reports of late where there have been reports where the United States has said, well, you know, maybe we're thinking about a Pakistan without Musharraf. And if you actually look at some of the rumblings in the Pakistani press and some of the press around here in D.C., you know, it does, there are murmurs afloat that maybe policy may be drifting away from the current set of policies.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to co-opt them to be more cooperative. It sounds like we may get rid of the Musharraf or not. He's actually wanting to run again, apparently, or at least indicated that before his term's up, he may go for another term. So, again, I'm just kind of puzzled as to why. I mean, are they not supposedly they're cooperating vis-a-vis al-Qaeda? So,
well, honestly speaking, the solution to this is probably a set of solutions that the U.S. is not going to be willing to even pursue, given its relationship with India.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the U.S. has the best relationship ever that it's had with all three of these states, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan. And one could almost argue that given that from Pakistan's point of view, being a very insecure state, looking around its neighborhood and having, frankly, hostile neighbors on each border, one would think if there was a time to resolve Pakistan's insecurity perceptions, the time would be now. But given that the United States have really pursued a very different relationship with India, President Bush last summer basically said explicitly that we're going to do what it takes to make India a global power, it seems as if asking India to make some sort of commitment to resolve the LOC, to give some incentive to Pakistan to sign off on its disputed border with India, to finalize that border and to put to rest that security competition, encouraging the Indians to not take what I would call provocative positions in Afghanistan and Iran, to resolve the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. I mean, what we really need to get Pakistan, to the extent that the state is in fact sponsoring these activities, we need a regional solution, one that takes into account the multiple facets of insecurity that Pakistan as a state has.
Well,
you know, I see no evidence that the government is taking that sort of approach to the region.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles.
Thank
Chris
you.
Fair. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. So just speaking there with Dr. Chris Fair, a senior research associate at the United States Institute of Peace Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention, where she specializes in South Asian politics and military affairs. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Jess Shepard, the engineer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Coote, the assistant producer. This program and all previous ones available at ianmasters.org.